Steve Martin is still finding new ways to make people laugh. 40 years on stage, on record albums, on the big and small screens, sometimes playing his banjo, the comedian is now on Twitter with nearly 2.5 million followers. And his funny, slightly demented Twitter feed has gone old school, collected on paper in a book, where many of the biggest laughs come from his followers' responses. When Steve Martin came into our studio, he was carrying his banjo and quick to admit that before he started tweeting in 2010, he was skeptical.
I was actually talking to a friend of mine, Tom Hanks, and he was tweeting. And I said, why do you do that? Because I had this perception of tweeting that it was very low. And he said, well, I use it actually for a promotion. I talk about the movie I'm doing, and I sometimes tweet photos, and it builds awareness. And I thought, oh, that's interesting, because I was growing frustrated that when you do a movie or a record that you have to promote it. So I was going on television. You know, I was playing to an audience of 4 million, for example, and maybe only 400 of them were actually interested in my so-called product. And I thought, well, if I had a Twitter feed, and say I had followers of 100,000, that means 100,000 of them would be interested in my book, let's say.
Which is logical.
It was logical, but it didn't turn out to be true. It turned out if I had a Twitter feed of 100,000, 4 of them were interested in my book. So
it's proportional,
yeah.
It turned out to be.
Now I have a following of almost 2.5 million, and it turns out that tweeting is really only good for one thing. It's just good for tweeting.
When you first started, you were doing a series, sort of, it seems like, so something like a monologue on Twitter. I mean, there's one of these, starts with this nice saying, a watched iPhone never syncs.
I did a little series there. It's, my iPhone is now lip syncing, and iPhone just synced perfectly with Toaster.
Well, at what point were you at when you got to it's almost like a riff on jury duty.
This was inspired by, I was actually called for jury duty, like the third time in, seemed like 3 months. I started pretending as though I were at jury duty. I think the first tweet was, report from jury duty, defendant looks like a murderer, guilty, waiting for opening remarks.
It goes on, and you're commenting on the other jurors. Other jurors are stupid.
Well, yes, report from jury duty. Other jurors are stupid. They don't believe in hexes. Plus, they want me to put my magazines away. What I started to find was that when people started responding, I found they were really writing well. I remember running into my wife a couple of times and reading some of the responses, and we were laughing out loud, like, oh, yes. My tweet was, I was promoting my album, Rare Bird Alert, and I tweeted, Rare Bird Alert, number 3 on Amazon, I'm happy as a clam. Wait, are clams really happy? And a responder said, the chilling sound of clam laughter has caused many fishermen to quit the sea.
That's pure poetry. Why do you think people seem to be funnier in their tweets than they would ever be on comments on blogs and such?
I agree. And that's another thing I found. I felt like I was looking at kind of a new form of comedy in a strange way, that was talking and response and talking and response in a written way. There's some that make me laugh just kind of looking at.
Well, there's a whole riff on your caps lock key.
Yes, it was the premise that my caps lock key was talking to the audience when I was away.
And so everything's in uppercase.
Yeah, it was, hi, I'm Steve's caps lock key. It's all in caps. And I'd like to meet other caps locks keys. I'm interested in boating and hiking.
And
then a guy wrote back in lowercase, your kind are not welcome here. Yeah.
It is you have gained these comedic collaborators.
Yes, and I've always believed that there are funny people everywhere, but they're just not comedians. In fact, some of my best comedic inspirations were not professional entertainers. I had a friend in Texas, and his wife told me they were at an amusement park. And they came up to one of those maps, and it had a map of the amusement park, and it said, you are here. And he looked at it and he said to her, "How does it know?"
Do you, it does seem like there was a random thought that would lead to a theme. And as the book goes along, it just often seems like totally random thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
Like finally thinking about getting a computer.
Yes. I like the absurdity of that, that you can't possibly be tweeting and finally be thinking about getting a computer. And then people immediately catch on to it. You know, I like the idea that one thing leads to another. You can tweet something completely innocuous and then find yourself going off on a tangent that's inspired by a response. And, you know, these things appear on people's phones in the middle of the day. You know, it's not like people are gathered in a hall and they're expecting something funny. You know, talk about the unexpected.
Which is...
Yeah.
One of the key elements.
It's a good thing, yeah.
Of comedy.
And there's absolutely no reward but it.
But it's rewarding.
It is rewarding because it's just its own reward. It's sort of like heaven.
The book is The 10 Make That 9 Habits of Very Organized People. Make That 10, The Tweets of Steve Martin. And remember the banjo he brought in? After we chatted, he picked it up and played a new song for us, the song that you're hearing right now, which he may or may not be playing when his band, the Steep Canyon Rangers, goes on the road.
Spool back in time 150 years to the summer of 1862. The Civil War is raging, and President Abraham Lincoln is starting to scribble away at a document, an ultimatum to the rebellious states: return to the Union or your slaves will be freed. Emancipation was a military necessity, the president later confided to his cabinet. Lincoln called it absolutely essential to the preservation of the Union. "We must free the slaves," Lincoln said, "or be ourselves subdued."
He knew that emancipation would start the tidal wave of freedom and that it was irreversible once it started. But he also knew that more work would be required.
That's Lincoln scholar Harold Holzer, who offers a rethinking of the Emancipation Proclamation in his new book titled Emancipating Lincoln. It's his 42nd book on Lincoln and the Civil War. To those revisionist critics who now say the proclamation was weak, delayed, insufficient, and insincere, Holzer counters, "Not so." He says Lincoln very carefully calibrated the timing and delivery of this act.
He did things in this run-up that are perplexing, sometimes unattractive, sometimes scary, to prepare the country in his mind for what was going to be a revolutionary moment.
Remember, the country was at war. The stubborn culture of racism made a pro-freedom policy a perilous idea. Lincoln knew it could bring down his administration and the Union. Holzer says Lincoln had to fear a virulent backlash from conservative Northern Democrats opposed to racial equality, and he risked triggering secession from the border states, the slave-owning states that had not joined the Confederacy, Maryland, Delaware, Missouri, and above all, his birth state, the crucially strategic Kentucky.
Lincoln worried that he wanted to have God on his side, but he must have Kentucky.
So it was in that context, in August of 1862, that Lincoln hosted at the White House a deputation of free Negroes, prominent African Americans. His message to them, it was not, "You shall be free." No, it was this: "It is better for us both to be separated."
And he blames them for the war. Says this, you know, if it wasn't for your presence here, as if it was voluntary in the beginning, this wouldn't be happening. Go where the ban is not upon you, he tells them. Go to the Caribbean. Go to Africa. Yeah, they're cruel words. They're harsh words. They're unfriendly.
So how to understand this bitter pill of prejudice, as Holzer calls it? Well, he says it's telling that President Lincoln had summoned newspaper reporters to that meeting.
He wanted this message out. And what's important to keep in mind is that he had written the Emancipation Proclamation. It was languishing in a drawer. It was burning a hole in his pocket. He knew he was going to do this, but he wanted Northern Americans who were dubious about marching toward racial equality to be assured that he was not doing this for the black race. He was doing this for the Union, to reunite the country, to defeat the rebellion, and he had no concern about blacks, their feelings, their residence. He does have his finger in the wind.
Holzer says Lincoln was trying to mold public opinion to make the proclamation palatable, and the president was waiting for the right moment, a Union victory on the battlefield, which finally came at Antietam. Within a week of that victory, Lincoln gave the rebellious states 100 days to obey this ultimatum.
Either return to your legal balance with the Union and this rebellion, or your slaves will be then, henceforward, and forever free.
There was an immediate backlash. Lincoln's Republican Party was punished at the polls in the 1862 elections. Then, on January 1st, 1863, Lincoln was to issue the final decree at the White House.
It was New Year's Day, and by tradition, there was a party. And Lincoln went downstairs early and began receiving guests. And the afternoon comes and goes, and African Americans are gathered in churches. Telegraph operators are already keyed up to bring the glorious news to the church whenever it arrived, and nothing happens.
Why the delay? Well, as Harold Holzer tells it, Lincoln had found a mistake in the handwritten proclamation brought for his signature. The whole thing had to be redone. Back it went to the scribe. It took hours.
And then something fascinating happened. He picked up his pen and put it down. And then he picked it up again and put it down. And people in the room wondered, well, maybe he isn't going to issue it after all. Maybe he just can't bring himself to do it. And then he suddenly began rubbing his fingers with his other hand, rubbing his right hand with his left. And he said, you know, I've been shaking hands for hours, and my hand is almost paralyzed. If I sign the proclamation in a quaking hand, even though my whole heart is in it, people will look at my signature in 100 years and think he hesitated. And he just continued to massage his hand, and then he picked up the pen and signed his full name, which he only did on official documents. And then he looked at the signature, Abraham Lincoln, and said very proudly, there, that will do.
Those words, that will do, just seem like such a paltry way of encapsulating what had just happened.
Well, he had said right before that, if my name ever goes into history, it will be for this act. I think he sensed immediately that he had become one of the immortals.
One misconception about the Emancipation Proclamation would be that once it's signed, boom, slaves are free. Far from that.
Far from that.
Far indeed. Some areas of the South that had already fallen under Union control were not covered by the proclamation. Also exempt were the four border states that owned slaves but had not seceded, so nearly 500,000 people remained enslaved there. And in the Confederate states, freedom came only as the Union soldiers advanced.
Soldiers were armed with these tiny reproductions of the Emancipation Proclamation. Lincoln had ordered hundreds of thousands of them printed. Suppose an officer gets to a plantation owner that might not understand what he had to sacrifice. Here it is. These guys are free. You got to pay them or let them go, one or the other. And that's how it worked, mile by mile in Southern Territory.
On the cover of Harold Holzer's book is an engraving that shows a scene from April 4th, 1865. It's President Lincoln holding the hand of his young son, Tad, as he enters Richmond, Virginia, just 2 days after Confederate forces had fled their capital. Jubilant African Americans toss their hats in the air as they greet him.
They rushed over to him and cheered and knelt. And Lincoln famously said, and there were witnesses there, please don't kneel to me. You must kneel only to God and thank him for your freedom. This was Lincoln's real emancipation moment. These black workers were actually that moment free under the terms of the proclamation. Here is the Emancipation Proclamation in action. We know also that one particularly wizened old man who was working on the dock was wearing a big straw hat. His reaction to Lincoln when he saw him was to doff this cap in a very grand way and bow to Lincoln. Lincoln took his cap off and tipped his hat to the black man. There were white women, mostly. The men had fled. hiding behind curtains on the second floor of the homes surrounding the shoreline, who were reported to have been looking on with horror at this simple but deeply moving and meaningful gesture. This was Lincoln acknowledging, after all the years of struggle, with the end finally in sight, that this was going to be a different society, a society of mutual respect and not subjugation.
But that moment of quiet triumph was fleeting. Just 10 days later, President Lincoln was assassinated. Harold Holzer's book is Emancipating Lincoln, The Proclamation in Text, Context, and Memory. You can see the engraving from the book jacket and other images inspired by the Emancipation Proclamation at npr.org.
When you think of blockbuster bestsellers, what comes to mind generally are mysteries, crime novels, romances, not so much ethical or moral fiction. That's what Jodi Picoult calls her novels. With 33 million copies of her books now in circulation, NPR's Lynn Neary wondered how Picoult could be so popular by writing about divisive issues.
While promoting her new book at the Free Library in Philadelphia, Jodi Picoult made some members of her audience howl, literally. Picoult used this lesson in howling to show how much she learned about wolves while researching her latest book, Lone Wolf. It was also a vivid demonstration of Picoult's special talent for connecting with her fans. Her longtime editor, Emily Bessler, says that special bond with the reader was there from the beginning. Bessler remembers that right before she began working with Picoult, she saw two young women on the subway reading her books.
And I said, oh, you know, how are those? Are those good books? And they both went on for 5 minutes, complete strangers, about how they worshiped Jodi Picoult, how they waited breathlessly for every trade paperback. And I thought, wow, that's impressive. That's not what you hear every day.
At the event in Philadelphia, a long line of fans snaked through the echoing hallways of the Free Library, eager to get a moment with Picoult. It was the end of a long day, but Picoult was unfailingly cheerful as she signed copies of her books.
How are you?
Good, how are you?
Thanks for being here tonight.
Thank you.
What makes Picoult's popularity somewhat surprising is the subject she chooses to write about. In her novels, Picoult has taken on a long list of issues that a lot of people avoid thinking about.
Neonaticide, the death penalty, mercy killing, stem cell research, what it means to believe in God or not believe in God, the right to die, gay rights.
Just to name a few, Picoult takes a controversial issue and lets her characters hash out their differences over it, usually in the context of a family facing some kind of crisis. Picoult says she tends to write about subjects that keep her awake at night.
Really, I think I have sort of gravitated towards issues that I don't know the answers to, because that's what's more interesting for me to write. The act of writing it is the act of trying to understand why my opinion is what it is. And ultimately, I think that's the same experience the reader has when they pick up one of my books.
In Lone Wolf, a brother and sister must decide whether to terminate medical care for their father, who's in a vegetative state after a car accident. The sister, Kara, was also in the accident and is determined to keep her father alive. The brother Edward, who has been estranged from his family, wants to let their father go and donate his organs to someone who needs them. In this scene, the brother thinks the two have resolved their differences.
My sister is glassy-eyed, slack-jawed, almost asleep, but she fixes her gaze directly on mine. I can't do this, Kara murmurs. I just want it to be over. It feels like a plea. It feels as if for the first time in 6 years I might be in a position to help her. I look down at my sister. I'll take care of it, I promise, knowing how much these words have cost her. I'll take care of everything.
At the center of this story is the father, Luke, a researcher whose life was so taken over by the wolves he studied that at one point he left his family to live with a wolf pack. Picoult says she wanted Luke to be a larger-than-life character.
Because I think that's probably the most devastating thing, when someone who is larger-than-life winds up a shadow of themselves in a hospital bed. And one day I woke up thinking about wolves. No idea why. I have no affinity for wolves. I know nothing about wolves, you know, beyond what most people tend to know. And I started to do a little research. And I began to think, what if I created a guy who had lived with a wild pack, who didn't just study them from afar, but actually lived with them?
Vigo is not the kind of writer who just makes things up. She does extensive research for her books, delving into medical, scientific, and ethical research, visiting hospitals, even prisons if necessary. In the case of Lone Wolf, she learned everything she could about wolves and spent time with a researcher who actually had lived with a pack. But for all her interest in research and facts, Pico still believes she can have the greatest impact on her readers through fiction.
If you read a book that's fiction and you get caught in the characters and the plot and swept away really by the just the fiction of it, by the non-reality, you sometimes wind up changing your reality as well. And often when the last page is turned, it will haunt you. It's a much gentler approach sometimes into a controversial subject than nonfiction is.
Waiting for Pico to sign their books the other night, Rachel Minnick, Susan Berkelbach, and Carrie Dunn said they've been reading Pico's books for years.
Thank you, Jody.
Sure.
We feel very blessed because we've seen you twice now. So.
Where did you see me last time?
In Reading.
The three friends said they love the way Pico combines fact with fiction.
I love the fact that she tackles some really tough topics, and her character development is amazing, and you just fall in love with her characters, and her stories are just, she's an incredible storyteller.
Yeah. And what is it you like so much about her book?
I just like the different ideas that she comes up with, the different stories. They're just so interesting, and like Rachel said, they really make you think about things that you haven't normally thought about.
I think primarily I like the fact that there's so much research that goes into her books. I really do. I think that it's not just that she's a good storyteller, there's research behind it, so you learn something every time you read one of her books.
Pico doesn't take her fans for granted. She gets around 200 emails a day and answers them all. But she doesn't think it's just personal attention which brings readers back to her books year after year.
I think the reason that these readers come back to me is because I represent their points of view. It may not be my point of view, but that's okay. You know, everyone still deserves to have their say, and I always look at it sort of like the facets of a diamond. You've got to illuminate each one and then let the reader decide what's the brightest one and why. You know, my job isn't to tell them which is the brightest one. It's just to illuminate every single facet.
Pico, who also happens to be a mother of three, generally writes a book a year. She finished the first draft of her next book before heading out on this book tour and already has started researching another one. Lynn Neary, NPR News, Washington.
This Thursday, the 15th, is the Ides of March. It's an infamous date, especially for lovers of literature or Roman history, known as a day of betrayal. And that's where writer Myla Goldberg gets her theme for our series, Three Books.
I was in Mrs. Farrell's English class when I first saw the daggers come out. Casca led them, Brutus finished the job, and then there was Julius, a bloody wreck, on the floor of the Roman Senate. Not a March 15th passes that I don't hear a faint whisper in the back of my head, "Beware the Ides of March," and I've been hooked on stories of betrayal ever since. And so, here are three excellent books on the subject. Stephen Milhauser's brilliant first novel is called Edwin Mulhouse, The Life and Death of an American Writer, 1943 to 1954, by Jeffrey Cartwright. In the book, Edwin, an artistic genius, dead at the age of 11, is immortalized by his lifelong friend, Jeffrey. This satire of biographies also serves as an unerring chronicle of childhood, not just Edwin's, but our own. It's easy to forget, as a grown-up, that there was a time when almost everything about the world felt new, but Milhauser rekindles childhood's mayfly intensity. Jeffrey's chronicle of the doomed Edwin reminds us of children's passionate, obsessive friendships and cruel heartbreaks, their steely rivalries and, yes, their ultimate crushing betrayals, often at the hands of the people they love most. Next, we go to prison. In Invitation to a Beheading, poor Cincinnatus C. has been jailed for nautical turpitude, a crime he understands no more than you do. His execution date is pending, but unknown. He spends his final days being acted upon by people and forces that are sometimes cruel, sometimes surreal, and constantly hilarious, with Vladimir Nabokov misleading you at every turn in a way that will leave you hungry for more. Whatever you do, don't read The Book Jacket. It gives away the story's best surprise and most breathtaking betrayal of all. An anonymous Japanese village in an unnamed time of war is the setting for Nobel laureate Kenzaburo Oe's first novel, Nip the Buds, Shoot the Kids, which he wrote after World War II. A group of juvenile delinquents are evacuated to the countryside, only to be abandoned by the villagers there. What follows is a sort of inverse Lord of the Flies, in which the boys try to live with honor despite their deprivations, only to be betrayed first by a plague sweeping the land, and then by the villagers' return. This spare, affecting story provides a unique window into a time when many Japanese still felt misled and betrayed by their country, posing compelling questions about loyalty, generosity, and the simultaneous fragility and strength of the human spirit. In honor of the Ides, let's just come out and admit it. There's nothing like reading about someone in a terrible predicament to make you feel better about your own. Feeling betrayed by book recommendations that have fallen short on their promises? These books will not disappoint. Trust me.
Myla Goldberg, her latest novel is The False Friend. You can read this and other three books essays at nprbooks.org.
Marilyn Robinson has a new book out. This doesn't happen all that often, so we want to call attention to it. This book is a collection of essays. Many of them explore some of the ideas she writes about in her novels. The collection is called When I Was a Child, I Read Books. Ms. Robinson is in Iowa City, speaking to us from member station WSUI at the University of Iowa. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
Now, the title essay, When I Was a Child, I Read Books, that's in the middle of the book, and it begins, "When I was a child, I read books. My reading was not indiscriminate. I preferred books that were old and thick and hard. I made vocabulary lists." I wonder if you could read another few lines from the first page of that same essay.
Right. "Relevance was precisely not an issue for me. I looked to Galilee for meaning and to Spokane for orthodonture, and beyond that, the world where I was, I found entirely sufficient. It may seem strange to begin a talk about the West in terms of old books that had nothing Western about them, and of naive fabrications of stodgily fantastical, authoritative worlds which answered only to my own forming notions of meaning and importance. But I think it was, in fact, peculiarly Western to feel no tie of particularity to any single past or history, to experience that much underrated thing called deracination, the meditative free appreciation of whatever comes under one's eye, without any need to make such tedious judgments as mine or not mine."
Where did you grow up as this child who read books?
I grew up in small town, northern Idaho, west of Montana.
I gather that West is an important idea for you.
Well, it is. You know, I started writing actually when I was in college, partly because I felt as if the idea of the West was so misunderstood by people. Probably the understanding of the West has never recovered from the dime novel. And the idea that it's male, essentially, and that it is violent. And I just felt as if what was beautiful about it was really lost in this, you know, these very often very cheap dramas of violence and maleness.
And what were some of the old, thick, hard books that you're talking about here?
Well, I was very interested in history, you know, and so I read things like a biography of Oliver Cromwell and anything that I could get my hands on about chivalry. My grandfather, he went to college, and I think he was a history major. He had a big bookcase full of very old history books that my brother and I used to go through, sitting on the floor, you know, reading about the Roman Empire and so on. Well, I was always very interested in that sort of thing.
Another idea that you seem to be turning over and over in this collection is politics.
And I would say that I'm getting a sense that you think these politicians who are carrying on about character are leaving out something essential about the American character.
I think that that's very true. I think that American history has been very seriously misrepresented in most of the conversation that's gone on about it. I talk about John Winthrop's model of Christian charity as his, you know, the Arabella speech, and how that is consistently misquoted in a way that can only mean that nobody has read it.
John Winthrop, we probably ought to mention, was a great Puritan.
Yes, exactly. In the 17th century, he gave a lecture to, or a sermon, whatever it was, to people coming on the ship Arabella, which was one of the earliest ships to bring Puritan settlers into Massachusetts. The idea that we were a city on the hill meant, as it means in the Bible, that our sins and failures would be particularly conspicuous and impossible to conceal. And Winthrop makes that point very clearly. And then along comes the idea that we're suddenly boasting of being a shining city on a hill. There's no shining in Winthrop. It's an argument, basically, that we have to be generous toward one another in order not to fail. That's what he's saying.
I like the thread of faith that I find in these essays, and it's also part of your novels. I have the impression that you had some kind of a reaffirmation experience in the middle of your life. Maybe I'm making this up, but it seems to me that you allude to it in the essay called Wondrous Love on page 125. And I'd like you to read a few lines from that. You say that some of the things that have become important to you, you could never have anticipated.
This is page 125.
Uh-huh.
The importance to me of elderly and old American hymns is certainly one example. They can move me so deeply that I have difficulty even speaking about them. The old ballad in the voice of Mary Magdalene, who walked in the garden alone, imagines her tarrying there with the newly risen Jesus in the light of a day which was certainly the most remarkable daybreak since God said, "Let there be light."
Now, you also say, very early in this essay, that you never actually liked that hymn until you did like that hymn.
Yes. I have never heard it sung well. That is a fact. There's something about it that just, it's harder than the national anthem, I think.
Well, I can tell you from many years of my childhood of singing it that I think you're right. It has a sort of a seesaw rhythm to it that is just very hard.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the discussion of hymns in this essay then moves into a discussion of narrative, and that this seems to be something that people require, stories.
That seems to be true. There's a huge demand for them, in fact. The use of fiction gives us models of possibility. It gives us ways in which event can fall out, you know? And it also gives us the pleasure of a sort of deeper competence, as if we see a wider landscape because we have put ourselves through the rehearsal of possibility in these various ways.
Marilynne Robinson won the Pulitzer Prize for her novel Gilead. Her new collection of essays is called When I Was a Child, I Read Books. Ms. Robinson, thank you very much.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure.